Guitarathon is the greatest guitar sale on earth, and it's happening now. Get massive savings on a huge selection of electric and acoustic guitars, basses, amps, pedals, and other accessories. Get select Ernie Ball strings, 3 for $10. Save $100 on a Fender Special Edition Strat, or get a Yamaha acoustic for just $199. Plus, get special financing on select major brands. Don't miss these incredible deals. Available online and in-store, now through November 1st. Guitarathon, only at Guitar Center. Find your sound.
Today's episode of Locked On Cavaliers is brought to you by SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the best way for you to buy and sell tickets right on your smartphone. It's available on any iPhone, Android, or any smartphone you have, and they also have a great website for you to use. You can find tickets to anything on SeatGeek, and I mean anything. You want Cavs tickets? They're going to be on there. Browns tickets? They're going to be on there. Indians tickets? On there. Tickets to the concert that's in town tonight that you forgot about? You're going to find them on SeatGeek. Every deal is graded based on a deal score, so you know you're getting the best deal. There's not going to be any hidden fees, and you can see the view from your seat right in the app, so you know exactly where you're going to be looking at home plate from, or what your view of the Quicken Loans Arena is going to be like. And now's a great time to try SeatGeek if you haven't already. The Cavs are going to be playing basketball again this week, so you can use SeatGeek to get hard-to-find tickets like Cavs playoff tickets, because they're going to sell out fast if they haven't already, and you're going to want to make sure you can go, because the Cavs could be winning a second title, and you're not going to want to miss a second of that. And there's no place better to do it than at the game. My listeners today can save $20 on their first purchase by using the promo code LOCAVS, that's L-O-C-A-V-S, and earn that promo code under the settings tab, and you'll get $20 back on that first purchase. Download the app, use that promo code LOCAVS, save $20, and go see what you want to see.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome back to the Locked On Cavaliers podcast. As always, I'm Chris Manning, your host from Through the Sword. Joining me today, it's a fellow Ohio Bobcat, a fellow writer at FearTheSword.com. It's Michael Drabcho. Mike, what's going on?
Not much, man. Just trying to pass the time between Cavs games. Seems like it's been forever.
Yeah, we're going to have 10 days off when the Cavs do finally come back on Wednesday. That's an insanely long time. It is their longest break in the LeBron era, in the second LeBron era, at least, based on just a couple things that I read. Mike, before we get into mailbag questions for today, because it is a Monday, what did you make of the Spurs-Warriors game one and how that sort of played out?
Well, I mean, the obvious here is Kawhi's injury. Before he went down, when you're watching, you're thinking, oh, Spurs could challenge Golden State, not necessarily beat them 4 out of 7 times, but at least make them work through those 7 games. And even after he went down, they made enough plays to be in it at the end. But without Kawhi, that's an uphill battle that they won't win. And I know that's obvious, but
yeah, I think the thing for me that I thought was a little bit problematic was like the fact that they still blew a 25 point lead. The Kawhi's injury certainly like throws a series. I'm not sure how close that series would have been anyway, but a fun game one. We'll see if the Cavs end up getting that sort of game one, or if we'll get a blowout, or if we'll get something, you know, that's not competitive. And it's worth noting too that the Spurs and the Warriors, their game two is going to be on Tuesday, so they're going to have played 2 games in that series before the Cavs have played 1, which is kind of interesting. The Cavs, I mean, if both these teams end up sweeping, which certainly seems possible, the Warriors would be done, you know, just a tad bit before the Cavs, which would give them rest. And it sort of feels like, let's see who's gonna get the rest and whatnot. But questions for this podcast, as always, you can drop them for next week's mailbag or any future mailbags to lockdowncavs@gmail.com, to lockdowncavs on Twitter, and over at r/ClevelandCavs. So first question comes from Joe_Cavs on Twitter. He asks, Windhorse mentioned the Cavs exploring a Love Irving trade for Paul George this summer. would the Cavs be better than GSW if that would happen? So I haven't heard this, and I'm not sure of you either. It was on the Really Big Show, and now you can't get any archived WKNR 850 content, which is what this was on, because it's on that Land On Demand service, that paid for already aired radio service. That's $8.50 a month, which, you know, that's not a great business model. I don't know why. I could see why the Cavs would, like, ask about this. Like, Paul George and LeBron would be a very modern, switchy forward combo. Neither of them likes to play the four. I feel like you can't really get... I mean, Irving would be sort of the guy that probably be more interesting to dangle there, and Indiana might be more interested in, considering his age and everything. Love is probably the guy that's more expendable in that situation. I don't know why Indiana... If they're going to trade Paul George, I feel like they're just going to go full tank, and... I could see them asking about it, but I don't know how, like, it doesn't seem like likely to me at all. And if they did do that, let's just say it's you give only give up one of those guys for Paul George. I think it certainly gives you a chance to be better or as good as Golden State, but the Cavs are already there anyway. It would make you more modern and make you maybe the better deal with their smaller lineups, but that just seems like alternative timeline kind of thing if that were actually on the table.
Yeah, that deal seems like a bit of a head-scratcher to me. I didn't hear the actual clip when Windhorse was on air, but one of my friends was listening to it, and we had a rather spirited discussion about it not long after. And we both hit on, or you hit on a lot of the things that I thought about that. One of those two is going to have, LeBron and Paul George, of course, one of those two is going to have to play the four, which... as you mentioned, neither of them wants to. And I don't know how that would work if somehow they could get it to work with K-Love and they kept Kyrie, because Kyrie, LeBron, and Paul George are all ball-dominant guys. Yeah. Now, I understand it works with Kyrie and LeBron, but that's because K-Love's a guy that doesn't need the ball all the time, and you can reduce his role and make him catch and shoot guy, which isn't necessarily for the best, but it's possible. With Paul George, he's a guy that has to have the ball in his hands. And if I'm Indiana and I'm getting rid of Paul George, I'm just going to blow it up entirely, start from scratch, get a bunch of draft picks, and build up from there.
Yeah, like, it's trading for Kyrie or Love that are not as good of players as Paul George. Like, Paul George, like, one-on-one is more, if I think, more valuable than either of those guys.
Oh, I would agree.
Like, it's not going to help you really, like, rebuild in a functional way. So that seems kind of crazy to me. Next question comes from JimRun85, James Watson on Twitter. Since LeBron has returned, who do you think is the best free agent buyout the team has acquired? So let's not include Richard Jefferson. Let's not include any of the guys that they have signed, you know, in the offseason. So I think the buyouts, it ends up coming to Walter Tavares doesn't really count, or Eddie Tavares, and he hasn't really played anyway. So you have Dante Jones and Darren Williams and Kendrick Perkins are the guys to me that and Derek Williams would count in this as well. I think it's those four guys. I think it's Darren Williams, and I don't really think it's close.
No, that's a no-brainer. Derek Williams had some nice moments in the regular season, but his time's gotten reduced significantly in the postseason. The most notable thing Perk did in a Cavs uniform was hit Jay Crowder in the throat in game four against Boston 2 years ago. And I mean, Darren Williams has, ever since he has gotten himself in shape and he's shed those, what was it, 10, 15 pounds since he got to Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
He's looked, I don't want to say completely like the Darren Williams of old, but he's, you can see where he fits in with the Cavs, and he brings a nice spark off the bench, and he and LeBron play well together with that unit that T-Lou likes to run in the second quarter.
Yeah, it gives LeBron that pick-and-roll partner. It gives you something that can legit give Kyrie a rest and take some of the burden off LeBron to create offensively, which I think is pretty valuable. It's interesting, though, Dante Jones and Andrew Bogut also would sort of fall in this, but he literally played 58 seconds for the team, so it's just like, does he actually count, right? I think you could argue Dante Jones has made the biggest impact of any of those guys, though, on actually, like, winning a title, which is kind of, like, a crazy thing to, I'm actually pretty sure that's the best answer for that.
Yeah, no, you're right there, because, I mean, from what from everything that I've heard and read, seems like he's a good locker room guy. And on top of that, he had that stretch in, what was it, game six last year against Golden State, when pretty much all the guards were in foul trouble and he had to come in and give them 5-10 minutes, and he scored those 6 points.
Mm-hmm. Which is the most unlikely, like, thing ever that he did that. Like, just insane that he was able to do that. Next question comes from Tyler Thompson via email. He asked, from Athens, Ohio, go Bobcats. Always go Bobcats. First off, I just want to thank... Yeah, swack, baby. First off, I just want to thank you for the great work you do with your podcast. That's being generous. I'm trash. He said, I listen every day. First time sending a question. But anyway, my question is there any scenario which you see LeBron leaving Cleveland again, whether he wins another ring in the next year or two or not? Do you think he leaves Cleveland before he retires? I'm going to let you take this one first, because I've talked about this, like the banana boat stuff, before, but I'm gonna cede the floor to you for this one.
This is something that I've wrestled with quite a bit, and I honestly don't know how I feel, because it seems plausible that he could leave, and his relationship with Dan Gilbert still concerns me a bit. But the reason why I'm not necessarily sure that he would leave is because, going back and looking at why he came back and reading about his decision to return to the Cavs, a lot of it was legacy-based. Now, granted, the fact that the Heat lost to the Spurs in the finals that year, and that the Cavs had Kyrie and they had some pieces going forward, helped, but a lot of it for him was going back to Cleveland so he could, quote-unquote, right his wrong for the decision, I guess, and do right by the city and come home. And if that was the main motivation, I don't know how it would work for his legacy and just for him internally to leave again.
I think – I don't – this is, to me, probably the most interesting question about the Cavs for the next 5 years. Because I think you look at the timing of his contracts, he could be a free agent, after next year. He could opt out, which he probably will, because he could get that one more big deal. The timing for him to sign with the Banana Boat guys, which has always been the rumored thing that he'd wanted to do, you know, seems very close to the end. Chris Paul's gonna hit probably his last big free agency this summer. I have a hard time imagining he's gonna, like, sign a one-year deal. Carmelo's in his own contract situation, trying to get out of New York and all of that. If LeBron was going to leave, I feel like that's what he would do. He would go play with those guys.
Yeah, if he leaves, that's what he's going to do. But I don't know how that works with all of those guys, because, I mean, D-Wade's, he's near the end of his career. Melo certainly isn't what he used to be. He's a step slower. I don't think that there's a better chance for LeBron to win if he went elsewhere.
Yeah.
Or a team that's more ready-made to win.
Yeah, I think it just, like, it depends if that's what he actually, like, wants to do. And it just seems like that'd be unlikely to happen in Cleveland. Would it happen in LA? Like, they go back to the Heat? Like, that just seems like a very implausible thing. I kind of think he retires in Cleveland. I have no sourcing on that. Like, I have no actual, like, insight into his camp, you know? But that's just kind of my guess. I mean, it could be another 10 years, right? Like, this could be another 7 to 10 year thing, like, where he doesn't retire. I think you get a clear answer to that, you know, next summer. But LeBron, to me, also doesn't seem like a guy that's, like, gonna, because of his stature, because of how good he is, he's sort of in that star cal. He's, like, too good to, at the end of his career, like, do the, let's go play 1 year with the Spurs, or, like, reinvent myself as a role player, right? Like, he's not going to do what Vince Carter has done, or what T-Mac attempted to do, and other stars have done this. That's not what he's going to do. So, I don't know. I kind of think, this LeBron era, it might be at his peak in these next couple years, but he might still be around as Kyrie and other people are really, like, taking over the franchise inevitably at some point.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, but that to me is, I don't know if Kyrie's future and how good he actually gets and how Love ages are probably, you know, right up there in terms of how interesting a question they are. But I would probably say, like, what LeBron does sort of shapes everything. And that and, like, the David Griffin thing are probably the more interesting things for me. Because, like, this summer you could have a very much a restructuring if David Griffin does leave. And then, like, you know, what is if LeBron leaves, of course, that's a huge vacuum to fill.
That the Griffin, I guess we'll call it the Griffin saga as of late, has really piqued my interest. Because I know I floated this idea out there in an article I wrote for Fear the Sword, and I'm pretty sure you did as well. There's a chance that all this talk about Griff potentially leaving could be coming from his camp to get some leverage for a new deal with the Cavs. However, if it isn't, and he's, which I'm sure he is heavily sought after, he's done a great job since he's taken over with the Cavs, but if he is seriously considering leaving, that's pretty problematic for Cleveland.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And that's certainly been discussed, and it's something that you're going to have to, people have to keep watching an eye on as this sort of unfolds. Next question comes from Large Teeth here on Reddit. He has two questions. The first is, why doesn't Lou use Kevin Love in the pick and roll more? I think the answer to this is sort of simple. The Cavs their pick and rolls are very much predicated on Thompson, and they like using Love as a spot up shooter, and they do the Kyrie LeBron pick and roll. I think you could use him more in the pick and roll, but right now, and Lou said it's his fault he hasn't, you know, maybe got as big of a role so far in the playoffs, and that'll change in this next matchup. I think it's just not something they really they don't feel it maximizes their offense. And you know, Love is not exactly the perfect pick and roll guy. I mean, he's also not in these situations where the Cavs are going to hunt down certain players. The Cavs are going to hunt down Isaiah Thomas. They're going to hunt down Steph Curry. And Kevin Love just ends up not being in those pick and roll situations. So he's largely going to spot up. I think if you want to see Love use more, you want him getting the mismatches that he gets in certain points, and just getting him more post-ups in general is probably the way. If you wanted to see him get more and be used in as more than a spot up shooter and more like and less like Channing Frye and more like a Kyrie Irving in terms of what his actual role is, I think that's more like in the pick and roll.
The reason for, well, one of the reasons why I don't think he gets used often in a pick and roll situation is it doesn't necessarily play to his strengths all that much.
No.
He's a guy that when you get him the ball, he kind of needs to be set and then go from there to make his move or to go up for a jumper. He's not a guy that can really catch the ball on the move and then keep going, take it to the rack strong, because he's not overly athletic. I don't have a problem with them not using him in the pick and rolls in a pick and roll situation all that much. The Cavs do a pretty good job of finding the mismatches they want and then exploiting the crap out of him.
Yeah, he's been the per NBA stats.com, he's been the role man in the playoffs, 8.8% of his possessions this year, which is you know, not nothing, but that is down from 12.2% in the regular season. He's doing more spotting up, he's doing more of other things, but I think you're right. It's not like his strength to be the role guy. Like his best passing, even if you want to look at it in that sense, is coming from when he is set and he's at the elbow and he's creating and he's being able to sort of whip the ball around a little bit. And his numbers are pretty good. Like he's 8.8 points per possession in the regular season on pick and rolls as the role man, because he's never going to be the Kevin Love initiative. Pick and roll would be sort of like crazy. But that's down to 0.6 points per possession in the playoffs. So he's not just—it's just not something that he's great at. But you probably could use him more, like we've said. And his other question is, what does Derek Williams' future look like for the Cavs? Group him for a future six-man role? Question mark. So let me hear your take on this, because I sort of beat this. Derek Williams isn't actually that good horse for like a month.
Well, this is another one that I don't really have a great feel for, because when he first came, when the Cavs first signed him to those first couple of 10-day contracts, he was playing his butt off. Because obviously he was playing for his life. And he seemed to fit in well and to give the Cavs some good minutes, but I don't know if that was more product of just a lot of the guys being hurt and somebody has to get those minutes, so it went to him. In fact, that is probably what happened because, like we mentioned earlier in this pod, his minutes have gotten cut drastically in the playoffs. And I think if he were going to get a shot at potentially getting into that sixth man role, we would be seeing him in more than just garbage time in the postseason.
Yeah, I just don't think he's that good. Like, I think he has his value. I think he could defend a little bit. I think he can, like, do some stuff. He's a good cutter. But I think his best use is to really just, like, eat up minutes for guys. I would not be opposed if I can't imagine he's going to get, like, actual good contract offers this summer. You know, I just have a hard time believing that. There's less money this summer. That's something that we know for sure already. Teams have already spent a lot of money. I could see him want it coming back, and if he wanted to get some minutes next year, you know, he can play, and maybe you can groom him into being the Richard Jefferson of the team. And I don't know if he's ever going to be as good of a shooter as Richard Jefferson, but he's younger. You could get him tighter, a little tighter defensively, and have him and play that role because RJ is not going to be around. I mean, he's 37 years old. He's going to be almost 38 pretty soon here. There are certainly limits to how long he's going to be around, and if you have Derek Williams and Chidi Osman around next season, at least you have guys that you could maybe groom into playing that sort of role. But I don't think he's like a must keep. I think he was really fun. You may remember him this like his ultimate legacy with the Cavs, if you want to even like describe it as that, is that he was really fun for a short amount of time. And that's just like sort of all you can really ask for of a guy like that who has known limits. He's not a good rebounder, not a good shooter. And if he's not those two things, he's you can't really make him into a key six man piece on a team, or if you're gonna go small and that's where he's probably best used, you need him to do those things, and if he can't, like, what's the point?
Right. Let's not sell him short, though. His pregame dunks were filthy.
No, I mean they're great. Pre-game dunks, great. He's got great dreads. I'm a fan, but yeah, there's limits on what he's going to do. Last question. It's not something we're gonna answer specifically, but I'm gonna ask you for one thing about the Cavs this offseason, because I've gotten like four questions about this. The most recent one's from r/famer on Reddit. He said, can we get or could be a she, can we get offseason outlook and prediction? We're gonna do that in June, for sure. That's gonna happen. But just give me one thing this summer that you're sort of interested in exploring once when we get there.
One thing.
Or two or
Well,
three, like whatever it just pops into your head, just give it to me.
I mean, it's the obvious one, but the first thing that pops into my head is the David Griffin situation, just because that kind of dictates what else, what everything else, what everything else that the Cavs do roster wise going forward. If you don't have the guy that's ultimately calling the shots, or the same guy that's been calling the shots in there, the direction probably will change. And I mean, he's very few moves that Griff has made have not worked out. The overwhelming majority of the things that he has done with the Cavs over the last 2, almost 3 years have been really, really good. So the main thing that I'm interested in is will they be able to bring back David Griffin? And then, to a lesser extent, what ends up happening with Korver and Deron Williams. But I feel like Griff for the future is more of the immediate need or immediate concern.
Yeah, I'll add that the one thing that I'm interested in is one of the many things, I guess, because they're gonna have to retool some depth and all of that. My big thing is that I kind of want to see what they do with backup point guard, because you know, Kay Felder's contract isn't fully guaranteed for next season, so there's not, you know, 100% commitment to him. That's just like there's no way sort of around that. Deron Williams is a free agent. Like, do you bring him back, and what does that say about Felder? Does he play in Summer League? Do they target somebody else? Like, do they go after a Mario Chalmers? Because LeBron wanting a playmaker was a big thing this year, and backup point guards is the most likely place where you're gonna find that, and it gives Kyrie some depth. And there's just a lot of, I think, just a lot that stems from that spot. It was just kind of an interesting thing this year, And I think LeBron, they've really benefited in two different ways, because you had Dele, who's very one way, and Darren, who's a completely different player, filling that role. And they were valuable for the team the last 3 years. So that, to me, is one thing I would really kind of be interested to see. Because if they decide that they sign a veteran, that would say a lot about what they think of Kay Felder, or at least where Kay Felder is at. And that would sort of cast some doubt over what he might end up being for the team. And that, to me, sort of... because you just spend that money on him and whatnot. Mike, before we let you go, and then we'll have our... I have an interview with someone after this that I hope you guys will enjoy. We don't know, as we record this, who the Cavs are going to play just yet. Celtics-Wizards is Monday night. The Cavs will play the winner of that series either Game 1 in Boston Wednesday or Game 1 at home against Washington, both on Wednesday evening at 8:30. Give me one thing about Boston and one thing about Washington, about those teams that you kind of want to see how the Cavs react to in the Eastern Conference Finals.
For Washington, I want to see how they defend John Wall and Bradley Beal. Because if they end up advancing, which most people believe they will, they'll more than likely be facing another dynamic backcourt in Steph and Clay. So I want to see how they can handle two legitimate scoring threats in the backcourt in John Wall and Bradley Beal. And I realize that they kind of face that in Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, but postseason Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan and regular season DeRozan and Kyle Lowry are two totally different things. And then from the Boston standpoint, I'd like to see how the Cavs handle the way Boston defends. They'll pressure the ball quite a bit. And a couple times against Toronto, LeBron and Kyrie got pretty sloppy with the ball. Mm-hmm. And that's something that needs to be cleaned up going forward.
Yeah, I think that's what they're doing. I want to see how the Cavs would defend the 5-1 pick and roll Boston's used, and I want to see how they would adapt their defense to fit Washington, where they're going to have, you know, a lot of the time, not all the time, but in crunch time and in early in the game when there's two really good creators on the floor with Beal and Wall. That to me is sort of kind of telling. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the pod today, and just give everyone a reminder where they can find you on Twitter.
You can find me at M_Drapcho, DRAPCHO 21.
Cool, buddy. Thank you. And now I'm happy to be joined, as I teased a minute ago, by Adam Cribbley, the author of the book Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. Adam's a history professor at Southeast Missouri State, and I think you really enjoy our conversation. We covered the Miracle of Richfield, Mark Price, Nate Thurman, the 70s NBA, and just a bunch of really fun NBA history topics. And we'll be back tomorrow reacting to whoever the Cavs are going to face in the Eastern Conference Finals. That'll be a great conversation, I'm sure. Hope you guys enjoyed today's pod. Always drop in questions to LockedOnCavs@gmail.com, to LockedOnCavs on Twitter, or over at r/ClevelandCavs. Thanks again for listening. And now here's myself and Adam Cribbley talking about the book Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
So today on the Locked On Cavs podcast, I'm very happy to be joined by Adam Cribbley. He is an assistant professor of history at Southeast Missouri State University, and he's the author of an upcoming book called Tall Tales and Short Stories, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. Adam, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris.
So the first thing, before we get into the book, I was looking at your author bio on Amazon, and I saw your previous book was Parading Patriotism, Independence Days in the Urban Midwest from 1826 to 1876. How do you go from writing that book to writing a history about the NBA?
That's a great question, and one that that a lot of my colleagues have asked me as a professor. So my first book was basically my doctoral dissertation when I got my PhD from Purdue, and that was a project I'd worked on for a couple of years. And honestly, at that point, I was kind of burnt out of the 19th century. I was just doing some reading for fun, which I hadn't really been able to do for a couple of years, and stumbled across some really interesting books, both about basketball history and about the history of the 1970s and other sports. And so I kind of stumbled into this. This wasn't a kind of happened. And so my original field is, you know, I still teach classes in 19th century American history and still do some work in that field. But yeah, this kind of started as a side project and definitely become something that I've continued to pursue since.
So did you grow up like a big NBA fan? Was that like, was this like your sport, or is this just something that when all this sort of happened that this kind of came up and seemed like an interesting story for you to research?
Well, a little bit of both. I definitely grew up a huge NBA fan, a huge college basketball fan as well. I grew up in Columbus when Ohio State was really good back in the early 90s. And so was really big into college basketball at the time. Became a pro basketball fan a little later in life, maybe middle school, high school age. And so have been following basketball for, you know, 20, 25 years, and really fell in love with basketball at an early age. Was able to play through high school and college for a little bit. And so I've always kind of had that the love of basketball, but it's really just been with this book that I've kind of combined my love of basketball with my career as a historian.
So why this era? Why this, you know, the 70s, these specific characters? What about them really appeals to you?
Well, it kind of started with a book about baseball in the 1970s called Big Hair and Plastic Grass. And so I was reading this book, like I said, kind of reading for fun, and really enjoyed it. Got to know a little bit about the 70s and really the cool cultural changes going on in that decade. And then as I thought about it with basketball, I thought, you know, I knew a lot about Bill Russell in the 1960s and kind of this silver age of basketball. And I knew quite a bit about Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and how they supposedly saved the NBA in the 1980s. And then you have this the period in between there, the 1970s, that really just hadn't gotten a lot of treatment. There have been, you know, a few books here and there covering specific teams or a few biographies, but really no one had really looked at the 1970s as a whole, and not only tracing what's going on in basketball, but also kind of linking that back to political changes and cultural changes and social changes. So I found a pretty big gap in what had been written about basketball, and so it really appealed to me as I got to learn more about the stories and watch some video of the decade. It really became something that I really grew to love. The 1970s were, I think I've described it elsewhere as kind of the awkward teenage years of the NBA, where it's kind of growing and maturing into what it would become. And to me, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because like the 60s, you know, you think of the Celtics, you think of Wilt, you think of, you know, you don't really think of the 70s as this basketball era. Like the 80s had had Magic and Bird, and they had Jordan entering the league. The 90s are, of course, Jordan's decade. You know, the 2000s, it's a little different. You have the Lakers, you have those Pistons teams, you have the rise of LeBron James. Now it's LeBron, it's the Warriors. The 70s, you know, they have obviously a ton of great characters. The Cavs have a part in that story. Pistol Pete is a big part of that story. But it's not like it doesn't seem like there is like that exact, like, defining thing of the 70s in a way that we might associate other decades.
Right, and I think that not only is there not a defining team, but outside of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's clearly the best player in the decade,
right,
you could have arguments about who the second best player of the decade is that would just really not have a well-defined answer. It'd be that you'd get good arguments for a lot of different people. And so I think not only was there not a dynasty of the decade, but really outside of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was kind of standoffish and aloof in a way and was hard to relate to, is that there really wasn't a player that we can really point to and say, oh, they were clearly, you know, the second or third best player in the league at that time. So there was, you know, there's lacks that dynasty, lacks those transcendent superstars that we kind of associate with other eras. And I think to me, again, that made it more appealing.
Do you have a favorite character or a season or like a franchise that you maybe learned about from this book that stood out to you at the end?
Well, I'll tell you that I didn't know that the Buffalo Braves existed until I started researching this project. You know, I'd heard that the Clippers were in San Diego before they were in LA, but the old Buffalo Braves actually became one of my favorite teams. They came in, I believe, the same season as the Cavs. Could be off by a season, but I believe that they came in at the same time, and they quickly became this really strong nucleus, this strong core. You know, if you're going to compare it to a modern team, maybe the Thunder when they had Westbrook and Harden and Durant. they had several high-powered offensive players. They had this juggernaut. And then, as soon as you blink your eye, they have injuries. People are traded away, and all of a sudden they become terrible and end up the Clippers. So that they became a favorite team because they were so much fun to watch early in the decade, and then they just collapsed by the middle of the decade. Favorite character and favorite season, to me, kind of go together. I really like the 1976-77 season because you include the four ABA teams that joined because of the merger in 76. And so you get all these kind of dream matchups. And so one of my favorite players is, as you could probably guess from the title, is Julius Erving. And so Dr. J comes in, and he's almost like this, I think somebody called him a phantom or something like that, that people had heard about him and maybe watched him a little bit, but until he got in the league, they really didn't realize how special of a player he was. And so although he may not have been the character, the over-the-top kind of cartoonish character, watching his game was amazing. And so that, I think, kind of, a dark horse team would be the Buffalo Braves. But the easy answer for favorite character, favorite era, those 1976, 77, Julius Erving.
Erving's the one for me, one of the guys that I've always liked watching on YouTube. Like, I've read some about Pistol Pete's another, just because I feel like if he was a player today, he's one of those guys that would have been like a Twitter sensation, right? Like, just how he played was just like sort of not like perfectly fitting of that era. The Cavs are in a, I guess, the biggest part of your book that from what we've talked about, they play part in the 1975-76 season. And diehards out there are going to know that's the Miracle of Richfield season. This isn't the most unlikely success story ever, but when you were going through this, where do they sort of fit amongst the teams that were unexpectedly interesting or unexpectedly successful?
I really like that you used the word interesting there, because they're super interesting. So the Cavs came in as an expansion team, and they were terrible. They were so bad their first couple seasons, and they seemed to be snake bit as well, where they would draft a player. Austin Carr is a great example of this. Phenomenal talent, but he struggled with knee injuries, and he never really became that superstar that everybody predicted. And so they just kind of struggled. They were the kind of team that if there was one dominant player in the draft, well, then they were picking second or fourth. And they just kind of seemed to miss out on all these transcendent players that are coming out early in the decade. And so then in 75, they just kind of put it together. And it's not really the Miracle of Richfield is not really an upset so much as it is just an epic series. And so the Cavs in the regular season, I believe, had won 49 games. And the Washington Bullets, who are the team that they beat in the Miracle of Richfield, had won 48. So they had actually won more games than Washington, although Washington was, to me, probably the best team throughout the decade. They were consistently contenders for the NBA title. And so a lot of people just assumed that the Bullets would win. After all, they were a veteran squad and had Elvin Hayes and Wes Unseld, two very good players, two future Hall of Famers. And the Cavs just kind of had this mishmash of players. If you look, the Cavs were about 10 deep that year. They were a very deep and talented team, but they didn't have a dynamic star. And so they were super interesting in that they kind of bring all these pieces together and they make this playoff run. And again, I don't think we can really understand how exciting this was for Cavs fans who had never had any kind of success. Now all of a sudden, not only to have one of the best games in franchise history, but to have three in a seven-game series that come down to buzzer beaters. And, I mean, the city's just going crazy, just overwinning. I mean, this isn't an NBA title. This is just a simple playoff series. It's, I believe, the conference semifinals. And but the town goes crazy because it's this community poll. And so to me, that was, oh, absolutely. It's one of the most interesting things I researched about in my book.
Nate Thurman, in a lot of ways, when you look back at that and just reading about it, and this comes through, I think, in your book really well from the chapter I read, he feels like the jolt to that Miracle of Richfield squad in a lot of ways. When you look back at that team, is he the MVP of that year, or is it somebody else, or is it a combination of Thurman and players on that team?
So I think you have to define, MVP, and I always hate the the you know, MVP has to be the person that puts up the best statistics or something like that. You know, as far as most valuable to his team, I think Nate Thurman clearly was the MVP of that team because he just seemed to give them a veteran presence. He was going from, you know, being an all NBA player in Golden State. He had a 1 year stint in Chicago that went really poorly because he was asked to do to play a role that he'd never really played before, kind of a facilitator, almost like the triangle offense that they were playing, throwing the ball into the low post. And then with Cleveland, he kind of jump starts his career in his 12th NBA season. But he provides veteran leadership. He'd been there. He'd won one playoff series before. And so he really is the heart and soul. And I think it's telling that of all the, you know, of all the great players in Cavs history, that Nate Thurman's jersey is the very first one the team retired, despite the fact that he plays, you know, less than 100 games over two seasons with the Cavs. His is the first retired because of how he became really the heart and soul of that Cavs team. So I think off the court, clearly he was the MVP. You know, on the court, there were, I think they had six or seven players that averaged in double figures. So it's hard to really, and Thurman wasn't even one of them. But as far as off the court, he was clearly the MVP.
Yeah, there's so many interesting characters in that team. Like the coaching is its own fascinating thing with Fitch. You have Austin Carr, who now is like synonymous as Mr. Cavalier, even though, like you said, he was this great college player who gets snake bitten and never has the type of scoring NBA career that a lot of people thought he would have. And it's just not like guys that you would associate as these all-time great players. Like if you're talking about the most talented Cavs team as ever, they're probably not even you could argue that they're maybe not even in the top like five or top 10. Like you just think about the raw talent. You think about the LeBron teams the last couple of years, the 80s Cavs, even maybe the part of the last LeBron run, the first LeBron run. This was just a group of guys that seemed to just sort of gel, and even if they wasn't unlikely because of how good they were all year, they weren't like they shouldn't have maybe necessarily been like expected to be this really forceful team for that little bit that they were.
Yeah, and I think that they also do this at a really unique time in NBA history where the ABA is still in existence. The NBA has yet to expand. This is the last season before the merger. So they really have this unique opportunity to kind of make a run. And they don't – you're right. I don't think they're probably one of the most 10 talented Cavs teams in history. But if you look at their depth, I mean, I'd give their second five against any second five in Cavs history. I mean, they're just – they're talented top to bottom. They actually – Their best two scorers, Austin Carr and Campy Russell, again, both who, you know, are still with the Cavs today, that those guys were probably their best scorers, and they were both coming off the bench. So they played a lot of guys, pretty even number of minutes, and really kind of won as a team, although, you know, that's incredibly cliche, but they did, and it seemed like every game somebody new was stepping up, and you never knew who was going to lead the team from game to game, and that made it, I think, really exciting for fans.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that brings us to, I think, a very interesting difference between that NBA and this NBA. And the way you described Game 7 in Miracle Virtual in that book, and it feels like something right now that if that was happening, at least maybe not to the degree like a Game 7 or some of the other great games we've had in the past couple of years, it would dominate our Twitter feed in some way, the TV coverage, at least locally especially. But it existed in this way that it was newspapers. It was radio. It was Joe Tate. You know, it was these very different things. That people wouldn't consume basketball in that way now, in all likelihood, honestly. For you as a historian, was that hard for you to research that as a result? Does it make it harder for us to, or does it make it harder for us as people observing the NBA as a historical thing, does that make it harder to look back and evaluate that at all, or does it almost make it more interesting in some ways?
Well, I think if you compare it to my previous research project where I was looking at the 19th century, there's a ton of material on there.
Yeah, right. That's like at least you have like it's 50 years instead of like 150 years or something.
Exactly, and so there is some video footage that exists, especially the playoffs. You can usually track down some footage of some of these games. So I was able to watch a lot of the Miracle of Richfield games. But it's impossible, really, I think, to translate the excitement and energy that we would clearly have a lot of video of, you know, Twitter be blown up because of these games. I mean, you have to Game 7 is in itself an incredibly exciting game, but you have to put it in context that Game 2 the Cavs won on a buzzer beater. Game 5 they won on a buzzer beater, and now Game 7, you know, they've got the ball with a chance to win the series. and they make the shot, and so the place just goes, you know, the roof blows off the building, and Austin Carr famously says, you know, that it was, you know, it's the loudest he'd ever been in any arena in his entire life. The sound of 21,000 people, an NBA record number of people packing into this game. I think they set records for four consecutive games in the Richfield Coliseum because people are just going crazy. And so the third buzzer beater win for the Cavs in a 7-game series. And I mean, you can only imagine how not only locally, but really nationally, there's so much attention being paid to this win. And of course, yeah, the newspaper coverage in Cleveland is pretty extensive, but this is also getting play in national markets, in the Sporting News, in Sports Illustrated. You know, they're covering this pretty extensively because there's a lot of interest in this, the excitement of the series.
Yeah, I mean, that very much tells you, and that's, I think even now when you talk to Cavs fans about that team, that era, that's almost some people's most beloved ever, even though you have the title team, which probably in a decade for people that are in their 20s now or even in their 30s now, that'll be the most beloved. But for older, longtime Cavs fans, that group, I feel like, will always be very special for them. When you look at the overall Cavs history and even in this era, where does this group rank among the most interesting Cavs teams or eras ever?
Well, I think as far as interesting, you have to rank it clearly in the top two or three. The title team, as you mentioned, is going to long be remembered for finally bringing an NBA title to Cleveland. But this is a group that has long been, you know, some of these players, like I said, are still associated with the Cavs. You know, Campy Russell's works in the front office, Austin Carr's Mr. Cavalier. You've got a number of people that kind of use this as a springboard to coaching. Butch Beard and Jim Clemens both become longtime NBA and college coaches because of their background here, and I think in large part, Bill Fitch is, as you mentioned, kind of this coach that had taken this expansion team and molded them into a serious title contender. And so I think it'll always hold a special place in Cavs fans' hearts. And I think that part of that is the mystique of they're not overcovered. This took place in the 70s, where interest in the NBA was generally pretty low. We don't have the internet, we don't have Twitter at the time, so. I think that little bit of that air of mystique will always kind of lend itself to this Cavs team and this miracle of Richfield too, which only adds to the legend and the importance of it as an all-time interesting Cavs squad.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think just the time they existed in, and just how Carr and Campy are just still around the team and very much part of the Cavs' culture. If you go to a game or you watch a game on TV, like, they're still there. And I think that's very telling that they are just very much part of the Cavs' history. And, like, a guy you mentioned, Nate Thurman, guy who doesn't play for the Cavs really all that long, maybe not even enough to, like, and for a lot of teams even get considered to have a jersey up. He's the first guy. Like, that's super, super telling of how beloved and just how, like, important that team feels like it is to the Cavs' history.
Yeah, and, I mean, to me it's still amazing that, you know, Nate Thurman becomes this kind of transcendent Cav, even though, yeah, he plays 115 games, whatever, for the Cavs over 2 years. But I think he does symbolize this, you know, kind of blue collar work ethic that this team became famous for. They were slow it down, grinded out defensive, but didn't turn the ball over. They made good choices. Again, they didn't have the dominant scorers, and so sometimes they had some players who could go one-on-one, but they had to do it as a team. And I think that really becomes the legacy of this miracle of Richfield, that it was a team, that you have the three buzzer beaters are all made by three different players. And the sense of team really is, I think, the thing that drives that narrative of the miracle of Richfield.
The Cavs are, of course, not the whole part of your book, but just for everyone out there, can you just give everyone a brief overview of some of the other highlights and things you think people will find very, very interesting when they do pick up your book?
So part of the subtitle of the book is The Birth of the Modern NBA. And so I think that one thing that my book really adds is the idea that the NBA changed a lot during the 1970s. It grew from 9 teams to 22. You have the addition of the ABA teams. You have increased emphasis on the slam dunk. At the end of the decade, they adopt the three-point shot. You have all of these modern elements of the game that come in the 1970s. And so the book is set up chronologically, with each chapter kind of devoted to a single season, and then a couple of chapters that kind of look thematically. But I think that the thing that I really hope to show is this evolution of the game over the 10 years that I cover in the book, and also how it really kickstarted the modern NBA. I think too often we look and see that the league was dead in the water before Larry Bird and Magic Johnson arrived. But I think that what I found in my research is that, in fact, the league had been changing and growing, and maybe there are some growing pains, but that really what takes place over the last half of the 70s is the establishment, is the birth of the modern NBA. So I hope that besides, of course, the miracle of Richfield and some fantastic stories in there from, you know, Dave Cowan diving for a loose ball and playing a game called, you know, butting heads with his teammates, and Bill Walton asking for a beer when the Blazers win the championship in 1977. And all, I mean, kind of all these quirky little fun things that are so 1970s. The big takeaway is that the game changed, and it wasn't, there were a lot of growing pains, but it's really during the 1970s that we see the modern NBA start to emerge.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Bill Walton like is part of that era just gives it so many interesting things, right? It's just Walton being who he is now. Like, it just adds even more credence to the interesting times of the 70s. I didn't even, like, until you mentioned his name, I kind of just forgotten that Bill Walton was this, like, figure of the 1970s NBA.
And he really does kind of come to symbolize the late 70s, the, you know, the hippie kind of anti-establishment kind of guy. And at the same time, you've got all of these really interesting players. You mentioned Pistol Pete Maravich earlier. He's obviously super interesting. You've got players like Marvin Bad News Barnes, who's been extensively covered with his, you know, his quirkiness playing for the Pistons when he came into the NBA. You've got the arrival of Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, the retirements of Oscar Robertson and Jerry West and Wilt Chamberlain and all these other all-time greats. And so there was really a lot of transition in the 70s, and a lot of kind of forgotten stars or stars that I really didn't even know about before I started researching the book. So the hardest part that I actually had in the whole book was trimming the stories. I went from, I probably cut maybe a quarter to a third of the book after my, between my first draft and the last draft. There's just so many great stories that come out from the decade that I think will hopefully entertain readers regardless of which era or which teams they follow.
Was there anything that you had to cut out of the book that you were really upset that you did have to cut out?
Yeah, the biggest thing for me is I'm a nerd about stats and trades and free agents, and I always wanted to look at how teams evolved over years and how they signed this player and traded this player, and in some cases that just bogged down the narrative. And so there were some big stories that I kind of had to cut out. There's a whole piece I had about like the shoes that they wore in the 1970s, the players that they wore on the court, and that was its own standalone chapter. So that got cut down significantly, but a lot of stats got cut and a lot of trades got cut where I focused on big ones that really made big differences to teams. But that was a hard thing to cut. Although thanks to websites like Basketball Reference, you could pretty easily pull up all the stats that you'd ever want and all the trades that you'd ever want. So hopefully this will maybe lead people down that path if they're like me and into stats and trades.
Yeah. So the book is Tall Tales and Short Stories, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. It comes out, we were talking about this before, you thought it was March 16th, Amazon says May 16th, and then Amazon says May 26th, but you can go order it on Amazon right now, you can pre-order it, and you'll get it the day it comes out. And from the chapter I read, I think it's great, I think you'll learn a lot. I learned a lot from just that chapter. And Adam, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Of course.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.